Cases That Change People's Lives, the podcast series. Good evening. You're very welcome to episode 6 in this series of Cases That Change People's Lives. In episode 6, which was the last in the series, we looked at the Murphy case, 1982. Which dealt with the taxation of married women at that time in Ireland. The sequence of events and the challenges involved in bringing this case to court were described by Professor Yvonne Scannell, who had been pivotal in raising awareness about the injustices involved with regard to the taxation of married women and ultimately bringing this case to court as a significant legal challenge. You will gain great insights from Professor Scannell's first-hand experience of how difficult it was to garner the resources and maintain the necessary momentum to cover the costs to bring a case of this magnitude as far as it needed to go to the Supreme Court. I really hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
The Murphy case was one of the most important cases of the 20th century, because it set the stage for the abolition of all sex discriminations against women.
The 1970s was a period of very high taxation rates in this country, as high as 70-80%. For married couples particularly, this was a burden, and even more particularly for women who worked outside the home. The anger and frustration was such that it led to protests and marches on the streets.
Like, I'm out walking and these two women are out walking. We have families and our husbands are not bringing home enough of a wage packet. And it's not for pleasure or anything else we're doing. It's strictly to keep kids in school, to try and give them a better standard. For what?
We work on sewers and drains. And I find that from my effort, I'm coming home worse off than I ever was before. And I have a family just being taxed out of existence.
Eventually something will happen.
So wagging them up.
Can't lie back and sit back and get clobbered all the time.
It's a form of protest. Obviously, if nothing is done, nothing will happen. So the objective, obviously, would be to keep put pressure on the politicians to reform the situation, reform the tax situation. That's the only reason, because politicians only respond to pressure.
We're in banking, and we know that the employers aren't paying tax. Still now, we go in 23rd every month, and we're lashed. And that's why we're here.
I have worked 6 days a week, but I can, it wouldn't pay me to come the sixth day on a Saturday. I'm paid 60 pence in the pound tax. So I travel from Lahore like to Galway, you know. It doesn't pay me to come in, like, you know. That's for the extra day. So, like, it's not very enticing to, you know, it's not encouraging to work, like, you know, when you're paying that kind of tax.
Everybody should pay their fair share. We're paying ours and everybody do the same.
This evening, we're going to review a case called Murphy and the Attorney General, which is particular reference to the taxation at that time of married women who worked outside the home. And I'm joined by Professor Yvonne Scannell from Trinity College Law Department. Good evening, Yvonne. Welcome. It's
Thank
lovely
you,
to see
Pauline.
You again. Casting your mind back to this particular case, which was described as Murphy and the Attorney General.
Yes.
Could you just reflect on how it was for married persons at that time before this case changed it?
Well, Pauline, in 1975, the top tax rate in Ireland was 80% of your income. And when a woman got married in that year, her income was deemed to be her husband's income. And she was taxed at her husband's highest rate. So if I had got married in 75, my salary would have been £75 a week, but it was going to go down to £24 a week because of my husband's highest marginal tax rate. And he was liable to fill in the tax returns, criminally liable if he didn't fill them in properly. And married women had no privacy about their income with their husbands because they had to declare this to their husbands. But the worst part really was that the tax rates were so high that it was hardly worth anybody's time to work outside the home.
What was the social impact at that time? What was the percentage of women working?
At that time, 3% of married women worked outside the home. Whereas nowadays, of course, it's 20%.
Which is, I think, the more or less the European average.
It was the European average, yes. Mm.
Was the view at that time that that the tax discriminations were contributing to fewer women in the workforce?
Yes, it was. Margaret Fine Davies in Trinity had done a study on why women were not participating in the workforce, and she found two main reasons. The first was, which is still a reason, that they wanted to look after their children at home. And the second one was because of the high tax rates. And the high tax rates meant that for some women, particularly professional women at higher tax rates, it just was not worth working outside the home because you could have a negative income. Because assuming your husband's highest tax rate was 80% and then you paid your pension contribution and your social welfare, you might be left with a minus.
In your own personal experience, had you tried to get around this in any way at the time? Did you contemplate any?
Well, like a good lawyer, I realised that marriage was not a good idea if I wanted to have my own income. And I actually thought I would have an illegal marriage so that I wouldn't be legally married. And I approached the chaplain in Trinity about this. And I said, why don't you just give us a religious marriage like they do in France and we won't be legally married? But he wouldn't have any of it. So then I decided, well, I'd get married, but I'd do something about it.
And doing something about it took quite a number of years, didn't it?
Well, I got married in 75, and in 76 and 77, the movement to change things really got going.
How did you and others conspire to do that? What were they?
Well, two things happened simultaneously. Our organisation, which was the Married Persons Tax Reform Association, was formed by a wonderful woman called Maureen O'Duchan and her husband, two teachers, national school teachers. And they were assisted by Maureen McHugh as the secretary and Ellen McCafferty as the treasurer. And they started a political campaigning before the 77 general election to have the tax laws changed. And simultaneously, I and Declan Gilson, and who was a doctor, had said we believe this was unconstitutional. So we joined up with the Married Persons Tax Reform Association and decided to do two things, to pursue the political campaign and to take a constitutional action to have the tax laws declared unconstitutional. Because I had done some research and discovered, as a result of studying abroad, that this same law had existed in other countries in Europe and had been declared unconstitutional in Italy, Germany and Cyprus. So I was pretty sure that if we tried it here, we should win as well. Mm. Not everybody was as sure, so we had the political campaign as well.
Mm. And in terms of the support that you received, was the poor perception as to whether there would be any likely success an indication in the way that people responded to the association at the time?
Well, it was tough work, really, because the association decided to fund this constitutional case. And this, I think, was probably the first time any group had brought a public campaign to raise funds to bring a court case. It might have been done privately before, but we were very, very upfront about this. And we asked people to join the association and to pay £2 to join it. And then to give us 10% of whatever tax discrimination they were suffering towards the fund. Mm. And we said we would return that if we won. In actual fact, only about 20 people gave us over £100. So it was hard work trying to get the money. And of the 20 people, all the committee did, and then a few others. So it was a lot of trouble to try and raise the money.
I think I recall reading somewhere that you had received nominations as low as 10 from the Irish Nurses Association.
Yes.
And 500 from the Irish National Teachers Organisation.
Yeah.
What about the trade unions?
The trade unions were not supportive, apart from the INTO, because there were a lot of married women national school teachers. And they were quite supportive because my father was actually in the executive of it. And then the two O'Duchans were both teachers themselves and they had fantastic contacts amongst teachers. But the Irish Nurses Organisation, to give us £10, was just pathetic. Mm. And Congress of Trade Unions, we approached them and Matt Griffin was on the Congress of Trade Union and asked them, would they support us? And they came back and sent us word that their legal advice was that we were going to lose and therefore they wouldn't support us.
Mm. So the perception was pretty negative about the possibility.
Yeah, they were very unsupportive, yes.
And were you faced with any ethical issues with regard to that yourself in drawing in the funds and being involved?
Well, we sort of knew that we couldn't personally bring the actions. The O'Duchans or myself couldn't be plaintiffs because we'd be raising money for ourselves. So we started looking for the ideal plaintiffs. And a lot of people at that time would have resented two teachers having two incomes, you know.
Yes.
So we were kind of looking for a nurse, because everybody loves nurses and thinks they should be paid properly, even still. And so we found a nurse and somebody else, and then they got cold feet and pulled out. And then we found the Murphys, who were two teachers, but they were just started teaching with very small incomes, about £6,000 a year each. And their discrimination against them was about £1,028. So they were ideal plaintiffs. And the other thing about the Murphys was they were childless.
And why was that significant?
Well, you see, there's a provision in the Constitution that talks about mothers in the home. And we were afraid that would be used against us. So therefore, we were looking for a childless couple. And we did get a childless couple. But actually, by the time the case came, the Murphys had a baby, Orla. And I can remember the night Frank Murphy said to me on the phone that they were expecting a baby. And of course, I had to say, oh, well done. And I hope everything will be fine and everything. But inside me, I felt, oh, dear, this is going to come against us.
Was that aspect of the constitutional used against you?
Oh, yes, it was. Yes. That was the main plank of their case against us, really.
Before going into that, just describe the political dimension to the campaign and how that worked out.
Well, the first meeting of the MPTRA was in June 77 in the Pelletier Hotel in Harcourt Street. And no political party except the Labour Party supported our action. And of the politicians, the only one really who supported us was Gemma Hussey. She was fantastically supportive. And Neil Andrews did give us some support, not actively, but at least he was prepared to say he thought it was wrong. And nobody else, really. So we didn't get very much political support. And George Colley said that if he allowed a separate taxation for married women, that this would discriminate against women who worked in the home. And he had debates with Gemma Hussey about this. And at the Fianna Fáil Ordaisch in 77, he said,
I have no sympathy with some well-heeled married women who are pushing a solution to their problems which would cost the Exchequer £20 million a year and which would discriminate against one-income families. Whatever solution we find isn't going to downgrade the role of married women who stay at home to look after the children.
That actually was one of the defining moments in the whole campaign.
Why?
Everybody resented him saying that. And they knew it was wrong of him to say that. And we got a lot of support from organisations that we wouldn't have expected it from at the time. The Council for the Status of Women said he was wrong to say this. The Irish Housewives Association said they were disappointed with him. The Irish Country Women's Association at their meeting in Killarney condemned what he said. So all the women's movements were on board at this stage. And we were on a roller politically because we were getting a lot of political support.
So it backfired a little on him.
It did. It backfired a lot on him.
Had he exaggerated the figures as to the implications of...
Yes. Well, this is usual state technique. When he started first, he said it would cost £60 million a year to redress the discrimination. But he didn't express it as redressing the discrimination. But by the time the campaign had gone on, it was reduced to £20 million a year. But I think the £60 million was to frighten the horses.
From my recollection, Mr. Haughey would have been the Minister for Social Welfare at the time. Is that correct?
That's right, yes.
And how did he feel about this impending challenge to the case?
Well, they did a few things to try and take the rug from under our feet. In 78, for example, they gave two basic tax allowances to married couples. So there wasn't a discrimination in the personal allowances anymore. And they reduced the issue now, and the discrimination really was about taxing the women at their husband's highest rate, that at the marginal rate, and it was boiled down to that. And I think they hoped to rely on that as the net issue.
So here you were with the challenge of getting together the appropriate plaintiffs, which you had some trouble in finding and found, and then raising the funds. Mm. Were you ever realistically going to be able to raise sufficient funds to run a High Court action of that kind?
Well, I was very naive at the time, and we thought 10,000 would fund us for the High Court. Mm. But we knew we had to get lawyers who would act pro bono, because we couldn't have paid, or it would have taken too long to raise the funds to pay our own lawyers and the other side. So we looked for lawyers who would act for us for nothing, but good ones. And we got Mary Robinson and Rory O'Hanlon, both of whom were excellent for the High Court judgment. And then for the Supreme Court, unfortunately, Rory O'Hanlon dropped out because he was working on the Whiddy Island Tribunal. And we had to get a new senior counsel, and we got Dermot Gleeson. And then the state brought in three senior counsels in the Supreme Court.
Goodness.
Yes, normally would be two or
maximum.
One. Yeah,
yes.
But this was three. So we had to get two to meet their three. So we got Kevin Liston, who was the father of the bar. Mm. And I have to say for the man, he never asked for a fee. And I don't know if he would have asked if we'd lost, but I didn't feel nervous about not paying him. You know, I mean, he wasn't greedy, or he didn't say, I must have so much up front or anything like that.
And did you find it easy to get a solicitor at the time?
No, it was very difficult. And lawyers talk about doing things pro bono. And I don't believe that, really. I think they do things pro bono when they want to do things pro bono.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when it's the type of case they want to take at the time they want to take it on. So it was very difficult, really, to get a solicitor. But I did eventually get somebody who had been in college the year before me, Alan Shatter, and he said he would take it on.
This is an unusual case in that you won in the High Court. And most people, when they think of a constitutional challenge, it's seeking to overturn a High Court refusal.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mr. Justice Hamilton, I think, heard it.
That's right.
Tell me about that. What was it like in the High Court?
It was a very short case, only a few days in the High Court. If it was on today, it would take 3 weeks, I assume, but then it was only a few days. We only had two expert witnesses, one Jerry McAvoy, who was an accountant, and the other Miriam Moore, whom we brought in to show that it didn't harm children to have their mothers working outside the home. And then the judgment was given in October 78 by Judge Hamilton. And we won on equality grounds, on the equality clause. He said it was discrimination against husbands in particular, whereas I actually think it was against wives, but mostly. And also that it was a discrimination against marriage, because if it was cheaper not to be married, and it was a disincentive to marriage. And we won in the High Court. But unfortunately, the state appealed it. And again, this is state technique. I mean, if you appeal it, that puts off the day when they have to pay. And of course, when we did win on the 25th of January in 1980, they had bought two more years without having to pay fair, without giving us the fair tax.
Yes. I think there was some anecdotal evidence to suggest that there had been a drop in marriages in the relevant years.
That's right.
That people weren't marrying because of the situation.
No, there were statistics which showed it. Now, it could have been the decline in religion could be another factor, and no research has been done. But at the time, it was estimated that there was a decline in marriages by about 15% between 73 and 78, when you would have expected them to have gone up 30%.
Then when it went to the Supreme Court, how was the case fought then in terms of the state's argument? I mean, they bring in these three very top-notch senior counsel to fight the case. And what were they really relying on in terms of their argument?
Well, they used other articles in the Constitution against us. But one was...
In particular, the state recognises that by her life in the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home.
And when they used that argument, they also used a second argument which said that there were many advantages conferred on married couples by law, and that these compensated for the disadvantage of this awful tax. But as Dermot Gleeson said to the state, that nothing compensates to the extent that the tax discrimination existed against the Murphys, that they'd want a lot of capital gains, concessions and so on to compensate for the income tax discriminations.
Yes, well, that was rather thin, because the kind of tax concessions that we're talking about there with regard to a capital acquisitions tax and transfer of property, which would really have only related to quite a wealthy bracket of
Absolutely,
people.
Absolutely,
so it had no relevance to the large group of people who were the constituency for the case. That was interesting. And the other aspect of the role of the wife within the home was that was quite invidiously twisted when they went to the Supreme Court, wasn't it?
Yes,
because the word neglect was used, that a
That's
woman
right.
shouldn't be given any incentive to
neglect her,
what was her primary obligation
yes.
and duty to the home and family.
And what was hurtful in a way, really, about that clause, because that clause in the Constitution could actually be interpreted in a very pro-feminist way by saying that if women choose to stay at home, which some women would like to do, they should be supported in so doing. Instead of which it was used against women who chose not to stay looking after children at the home. Mm-hmm. And a woman's place is a woman's choice, so her choice should be respected and she shouldn't be penalised, whichever one she takes.
Thinking back at that time, Yvonne, what was the public support and opinion generally reflected in the press about the case?
A lot of people resented people working outside the home at the time because there was unemployment of about 14%. And it was very difficult for men to get jobs. And also, people with two incomes were resented at a time when a lot of people didn't have one income or had inadequate income. So there were two strains, really. One was people who supported us on justice and equity grounds. And then there were other people who, on economic grounds, felt that married women shouldn't be working outside the home, that men needed the jobs more. And funnily enough, the research showed that the highest resentment group were older single women.
So it was one of those contentious issues that was divisive.
Yes.
We've seen many of them in this jurisdiction.
Yes, it was.
But you mentioned earlier about the defining moment whenever the comment was made by George Colley, that had a unifying effect.
Yes, it did with the women's movement. That got the conservative women's movement on our side. When you had the Irish Housewives Association and the ICA backing us, that was telling the politicians something. And I think that was a sea change, really. And it gave us huge encouragement. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the MPTRA wasn't a feminist organisation, although there were feminists in it. It was a sex-neutral, it was a married persons tax reform association.
When it came to the Supreme Court judgment, when you'd watched the case, and this is nearly two years after the High Court action, how confident were you when the case was progressing that it was going to have a positive outturn?
I was always convinced it was going to win. I just couldn't see that we could lose. But other people were more realistic and so on. And I remember the day of the judgment, which was the 25th of January 1980. And we were sitting in the court and it was one judgment of the five judges.
That would have been quite unusual, would it?
Yes, it was. Well, in those sort of constitution cases, that's the way it is. And he was reading, Judge Kenny was reading out the judgment, and I felt we're going to lose because everything he was saying looked as if we were going to lose. And it was only in the last 11 lines of the judgment that he turned it around and said,
"The court accepts the proposition that the state has conferred many revenue, social and other advantages and privileges on married couples and their children. Nevertheless, the nature and potentially progressive extent of the burden by Section 192 of the Act of 1967 is such that, in the opinion of the court, it is a breach of the pledge by the state to guard with special care the institution of marriage and to protect it against attack. Such a breach is, in the view of the court, not compensated for or justified by such advantages and privileges."
So we won on the marriage grounds, but we didn't win on the equality grounds, and I had always wanted that to be the ground on which we would win. And that was terribly disappointing, and the Supreme Court used a ridiculous argument which said that although the Constitution says all citizens shall as human persons be equal before the law, it also allows the state to discriminate in its enactments on the grounds of social function. And therefore, that the state could discriminate against married women because they had a different social function to unmarried people. And John Morris Kelly at the time was a professor of law, and he wrote an article about this. And he said,
"To use a difference in social function, where the quality of difference is acknowledged to be one expressly supported by the state, as the basis for less rather than more favourable treatment, verges on the eccentric."
And I think that was why Murphy is so important, because it set the stage for an equality action. And Hamilton and the High Court had said that we ought to win on equality grounds. So 4 years later, in OG and the Attorney General, an action was brought challenging a sex discrimination, and it won. But I think Murphy had set the set the scene for it, because the reaction to Murphy by somebody as important as John Morris Kelly, that, you know, the Supreme Court couldn't see that this was unequal and to discriminate on grounds of social function when you should be encouraging people to get married, was so, well, I'm sure it influenced the Supreme Court.
And at that time, they, because of the references and the authorities that had been put on your behalf, which showed, as you said, that in countries like Germany and Italy and in Cyprus, they'd had the same
kind of income tax arguments on
constitutional grounds,
which
was quite unusual for the 70s for Ireland to have been quite behind.
Yes.
And there was there US law as well? There was.
Well, the US law wasn't as strong. But in actual fact, it was the first Irish constitutional case where precedents from the continent of Europe had influenced the decision. And Maurice Kelly said that in his article. So this was the globalisation of Irish constitutional law. I mean, we'd always been influenced by Commonwealth precedents and by United States precedents. But this was this was Germany, Cyprus and Italy.
And Italy. And was there a suspicion because of the way the judgment was given that it indicated some lack of coherence between the judges on it, or that somebody had changed their mind at the last minute? Was there a feeling of that?
Yes, that has always been a rumour since, but you can never find out from the judges. I wish somebody would write a memoir and say it. But they say that what happened was that the court was divided and that at the last minute one of the judges changed his mind and then we won.
I think you've said that perhaps because of the way the judgment was formulated at the end, it might not necessarily sit as a great judgment in history, but in terms of what it actually produced, how would you describe it?
Yeah. Well, the result was wonderful. It was ecstatically happy. Everybody was in the Married Persons Tax Reform Association, and so was the whole women's movement. You know, it was an enormous victory for the women's movement.
And, really. And a defining moment.
Yes, yes.
Yvonne, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Pauline.
That concludes this Cases That Changed People's Lives Revisited series. I hope you've enjoyed it. And by way of a postscript, I need to acknowledge and thank a number of people and make reference to some of the losses that we've suffered since this was first made in 2005. Peter Mooney, the wonderful, talented radio producer that RTE made available to me, has since passed away. And the beginning of 2018, we lost Mr. Justice Donal Barrington, an esteemed and renowned constitutional lawyer, jurist, and eminent member of the Irish Supreme Court, and the other courts that he graced. I would like to thank Colm O'Neill, who has helped me to put this together and had the patience to bear with me as I grappled with technology in my small home office and attempted to synchronise my microphones and software to make the introductions and the recordings as smooth as he has managed to make them. I'd like to thank all of the contributors who are still with us happily and whose enthusiasm for the original idea managed to give us a boost at that time that we were doing something that appeared worthwhile. The good humour and the willingness with which they participated has never been forgotten, and I have been very grateful for the way that they gave of their time and shared so much of their valuable knowledge, insight and analysis. And to them, we're very grateful because the programme only exists because of their legal minds and their astute legal analysis. So thank you to all of them. And thank you to you, the listeners, for tuning in. I hope that you will find this podcast of interest and that it will be food for further thought for you. And I look forward to the opportunity of making some more programmes on this theme. In the meantime, I hope that you will find these podcasts on your favourite podcast channels, and it is, of course, going to be available on my website, porteomarketing.com. So, Until we meet again through this medium, I thank you for your listening in and your support in encouraging me through your listenership in becoming involved in doing some more programmes addressing this theme. Thank you very much.